Mary, thank you very much for that prayer. And Mike, thanks for leading us in silence. And musicians, again, thank you. I want to introduce myself to those of you who are new here this morning. My name is Christian. Most weeks, I have the chance in the service to get up and to share and to teach. And last week, Matt was here, and we're thankful for that. But I'm back on this morning and in the coming weeks. And I just want to say to all of you who are here, those of you who are here for the first time and those of you who are here each week, that I missed teaching last week, and I'm glad that I get to do it again, and there's a reason. And I hope that all of you hear this before we begin. The reason is simple. I believe that the ideas and the pictures that each one of us have in our minds about who God is are enormously significant in the way they shape our actions in the world. This is true for the person who is a Christian and very confident about their faith, who has a very clear understanding of who God is. Whether you are clear about this or not, it's the way you see God that often shapes the way you live in the world and act. Sometimes your actions show that you're not so aware of how you see God. It's also true for the skeptic, for the person who comes here this morning, and I hope there are a few of you here, who's not sure that they're really convinced that there is a God after all. Even you have in your mind some ultimate image of what's there, something to which you give your trust. Maybe it's your own intellect. But whatever it is that thing in your mind that will significantly shape the way you live in the world, the way you experience yourself, and the way you use yourself in the world. And so, for all of you here, I'm excited that you're here this morning because I have a chance, not first of all to share my own ideas about who God is, but to put before you and myself the images that Jesus had of who God was in his stories. Now, it's up for grabs whether his picture of God is what you ought to look at carefully and let influence you or not. That's up for grabs. I personally have found it to be true that this is the place where we find the most reliable and the only true picture of who God is in the stories that Jesus tells. But whether that's true for you or not, you'll have to see this morning. And so this morning, again, we're going to look at another story in which Jesus presented a picture of what God looked like. And the one we're going to look at this morning is found in Matthew chapter 20. Verses 1 through 16, and it's on page 801 in these Bibles, which you had the chance to grab on your way in. And if you don't have the Bible with you, that's okay. I have the texts up here. This story that we're going to look at is commonly called the story of the laborers in the vineyard. This title implies that what it's about mostly is a group of people who do work, laborers. And it is about that. But the story also has another figure, which we're going to look at this morning together as well, and that is a generous employer. In the story that we'll look at together and that I will help you see, we will both encounter a group of laborers, and we'll learn something when we look at them about ourselves. And then we'll also encounter an employer, and we're going to learn something especially about God when we look closely at that employer. Now, before we read the text or look at it together up here, I want you to understand what gave rise to this story that Jesus told, because when you understand that, the story is much clearer. In chapter 19 of the book of Matthew, which you have there, right before Jesus tells this story, in that chapter, there are two questions that are asked of him, and these prompt the story. And it's my contention that these questions live like they did in the men who asked them back then, in us today. Here's the first question that was asked of Jesus. A man came up to him and said, "Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life?" The man who asked this was a rich young ruler who was not a follower of Jesus. He did not follow Jesus. However, he saw something in the people who did follow Jesus and in Jesus himself that he wanted, and he called it eternal life. He saw some quality of being, some quality of existence that was better than anything he'd ever seen, and he wanted to know how to get it. And so he asked Jesus what good deed he would have to do to get it. There's a second question in that chapter that comes a little later on, and this one is asked not of a person who doesn't follow Jesus, but of someone who does. It's one of the disciples. He says to Jesus, "Look, we've left everything and followed you." And then he asked, "What then will we have?" Now, both of these questions, as I said, will live in one way or another in the hearts of everyone here, whether you're a follower or not. And what's interesting about them this morning, and what we need to see in order to understand the story Jesus tells us, look at these questions for a minute. Both of them come from minds that have a similar image of God. Think of it with me. You ready? Both of these questioners see God as one who has something that people want. And both of these questioners have an image in their mind of people as individuals who want that thing that God has for themselves, and both of them behave as if God gives those good things to people who have done something to get them. Do you see that? The first man wants to know what good deed he has to do to get that good thing. The second man wants to know, what's the good thing that I'm going to get for all of the good deeds I have done? In short, the image that lives in both of their minds about God is that God looks like an employer, and we people look like employees. Now, can you see that in your minds? Jesus responds to these two questions briefly in discussion in chapter 19, and then in chapter 20 he tells a story which I think helps show two things about their questions. One, he shows them that their image of God is partly correct. That is, in this idea that God's an employer and we're employees, there is something in that image that's actually right. And in Jesus' story we'll see that. But he also, in his story, shows that they are partly wrong in their understanding of this God, who is an employer who gives people what they've earned. Let's look at the story together. All right? This is Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 7. Here we'll see very clearly Jesus setting up the scene of the story that he wants to tell. Let's look at it together. Verse 1 reads this: "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them out into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, 'You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right.' So they went. When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, 'Why are you standing here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' And so he said to them, 'You also go out into the vineyard.'" All right, I want to stop there for a moment. The setting of the story that Jesus presents in response to this image of God is a very familiar setting to people in the ancient Middle East, and it is the setting of the day laborer waiting for work in the marketplace. The way it works in an agricultural society like this one is that those who don't own land or who are not skilled in a trade, the way they earn money to get what they need for their family and themselves is that early in the morning they go to the central place in town, the market square, and they get there before sunrise and they make themselves look as strong and capable as possible, and they wait for the time when those who do own land will send their managers out to hire workers for the day. Is this strange to you? This is pretty familiar, isn't it? The reason it's familiar to me is I used to live on the west side of Red Bank on Chestnut Street, and if I ever got up before sunrise, which was rare, just when I was going fishing with a friend, I always saw that as I passed the corner of Bridge and Chestnut, there would be 100 workers standing outside early in the morning waiting for someone to come and hire them. Has anyone else ever seen this in Red Bank? It's almost the same now as it was then. These men, it's a difficult way to earn a living, by the way, but these men had no other choice. And so the men in Jesus' story got up early and they went to the place where they knew that the managers would come to hire workers, and they stood there hoping that they would get something to do for the day, because without work for the day, you know what they wouldn't have? They wouldn't have anything to bring home to their families to support them. And so these men, early in the morning, would be desperate and full of hope for something good to do that day. Incidentally, I noticed every time I passed those workers, if I slowed down or looked at them, they would come moving toward my car quickly, because they needed something to do. And that's what's happening here in Jesus' story. So far, this setting is totally ordinary. On the other hand, there are two details that are in this first part of the story that would have seemed altogether strange to those who heard it first. And it's maybe a little harder for us because we're far away from this setting where these things happen. Let me show you what the two details are in Jesus' story that are strange. The first one is this. Ordinarily, the person who goes out to hire workers is a manager. The landowner is the one who goes out in Jesus' story. Let me tell you this briefly. The person who owns land in this setting is a rich nobleman. He is a man of dignity and honor, and he does everything he can in the eyes of the public, always to carry himself in a way that he has the highest level of respect from everyone. And that means that the journey from his land through the countryside into the market, where there are all these people who he would have perceived and everyone else would have perceived as socially and economically way lower than him, would never happen, because that would be a shameful thing. Because of that, he would have hired someone to go do it for him. But in Jesus' story, it's the landowner himself who leaves the riches and the blessing and comfort of his own property to get up early in the morning to go out and hire workers. And that would have been a terrible surprise to the people who heard this story. Do you see how it would be surprising? Here's a second surprise. The frequency with which this landowner repeats the movement from his home out into the place where he can hire workers is just weird. Early in the morning is the first time he does it. That would be 6 a.m. That's when he goes out to hire people. But then look what happens. 3 hours later, at 9, he goes out again, and he does it once more. Maybe by 9 o'clock, the workers who were there were still thinking there's a chance that perhaps they could get hired. But when noon rolls around, you are sitting out there feeling like a total failure, because there's no way you have hopes of getting some work to do for the day. But look, he goes out at noon again. And then, not only is he out at noon, he goes out at 3, and then 5 o'clock. When you look at this picture of the landowner, the impression you get is this. He cares about nothing as much as giving people work to do. The impression is, he cares less about the profits that he can make from his fields than he does about the people themselves who will be standing there idle all day and have nothing to get at the end of the day. He cares more about gathering people up and sending them into the fields than almost anything else. That's the only reason why he would express this sort of action, repeatedly going out again and again. He seems obsessed with finding people to give work to. Not get work from, but give them to. Because look at the last time he goes out. You see it says 5 o'clock? You know what time the work day ends? 6. At 5 o'clock, there's 1 hour left in a 12-hour work day. He's still going out to hire people. That means 92% of the day is done. There's just 8% left. And he's still going out to put people to work. Now, this is the image that Jesus starts with. A landowner who goes himself to the people, and a landowner who cares immensely that people have work to do, even if they found nothing when there's only 8% of the day left. This story that Jesus is telling is a story about who God is and about who we are. And this is the first moment where we see the image that these questioners had in their minds was partly right. And it was partly right because the God that lived in the mind of Jesus, the God that he wanted to show us, was a God who is like an employer in relationship to us who are like employees. And what we learn about this God is, first of all, that he cares so much about the work that his people, his employees would do, that he comes himself. That he's willing to come right down with them to give them work to do. And that he doesn't just give people one chance to do good work. He comes at 6 in the morning, and then again, and then again, and then again throughout life until there's only a little bit of life left. And so what it teaches us about this God is that whether you have 92% of your life ahead of you or 92% of your life behind you, he has work for you to do. Now, there are some people in here this morning who have 8% of their life left. And we live in a world that would tell you, you have no productivity left in you. A world that would see you standing in the marketplace and say, you're worth nothing anymore. The God in Jesus' story says, no, you're still worth something good. And so in Jesus' story, this landowner comes to people who have been working from 6 in the morning on, all the way to those who have been doing nothing up until 5. Now listen, there are people here this morning who have been at work for God already for some time, aren't there? And then there are some of you this morning who are here who haven't yet begun to work at all. And you're sitting here wondering what it is that this God would want from you, or what sort of God is this that we learn about when we listen to Jesus? I'll tell you, you must see this. It's a God who looks at you and sees someone that he would like to set to work in the world. And that's true for you whether you've not started yet or whether you've been working all along. The God that we meet in Jesus' story is an employer who owns a vineyard and who wants to send you to work into it. And the life that that first questioner saw that he wanted so bad, the life that was full of hope, the life that was full of purpose, the life that was directed and good and bright and shining, the life that was exciting and full of adventure, the life that was good for others in the world and therefore were so attractive to that first man, that life is there for us to have, but only when we are ready to open our ears to the master who owns the vineyard and listen to how he will call us into that place to do his work. Do you hear me? I'm not sure if you do because there's a few people that are nodding. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now listen, I want to make this as practical as I can. What's the vineyard, and what sort of work counts? And the reason I want to ask those two questions is if the God that lives in the stories that Jesus tells, if this God is the God that we really are about in our lives as Christians or those who are looking for God, then it means that we all must ask ourselves, what's the vineyard, and what's the work? Okay, can I make it practical? Maybe for some of you, the vineyard is the kitchen at your home tomorrow morning. Your daughter comes to you and says, I want that thing that all my friends have. Everyone else has it. I want it. I don't know if that was a clearing of the throat or a chuckle from experience. You think in your mind, yes, I know you want it, and I know everyone else has it, but I know it's not good for you. Has any parent ever experienced that? Any parent here this morning? And then you also know that if you say this to her, she will hate you and think that you are the enemy. Because you're trying to take something good from her. This is the vineyard right now. This is the vineyard in your kitchen. And you as a parent are a good worker or a bad worker. If you look at that child and say, the most important thing is that they like me, you are a bad worker in the vineyard. But if you say, no, I know that what God wants is for this child to grow up with the right priorities, so that they can go into this world and be someone who goes in the other direction of the corrupt commercialism that's eating away at everything that matters in our world. And so I'm going to say the thing that is right but makes them hate me rather than the thing that's wrong and makes her like me. And then you're a good worker. Okay, maybe the vineyard isn't the kitchen for you. Maybe tomorrow morning by 8:30, a lot of you will have taken the car or the train into your vineyard. You're at the office. If you will let this image of God shape the way you see things, yourself, and the world around you, what you will see, if you will open your eyes at the office, is a vineyard all around you. And there's so much work to do in that vineyard. And if you will see yourself correctly, you will know that you are called by this landowner to be at work in that vineyard. Maybe you overhear a coworker telling someone else that his spouse of many years has decided to divorce him out of nowhere. You can hear in his voice that he jokes a bit, but at the same time, there's a broken heart beneath it. Now, what do? You could pretend you didn't hear it. That wouldn't be directly wrong. But on the other hand, with that knowledge in your mind, you could go back into your office and sit down and say, God, what do you want me to do in this moment? How can I be a good worker in this vineyard? Oh, give me the right words to say, please. And then you walk out of your office and you go to that worker and you say right to his face, hey, I overheard what you were saying, and I was thinking about it. If I were you, I guess I would want someone to just listen to me. And if you don't want it, fine, but maybe after work today, I'd be happy to just sit and listen to you. And then in that moment, when you listen, you are a good worker when you bear into that hopeless situation the hope of the God who is the God of all peace and hope, because you know that God, and he sends you to work by listening lovingly. Is there anyone in here who doesn't know a person who's having a hard time in life right now who could use an open ear? I'll take that silence as an indication that we are all connected to someone who could use a listener. Every time you're in the presence of a soul that's suffering, you are in the vineyard. And the master who comes at 6 in the morning, at 9, at noon, at 3, and at 5 is coming to you saying, please go do this work in the world. You do this work and you will have real life and that person will get what they need. This is the God that lives in Jesus' story. Listen, you all of us, I am too, we are in a vineyard right now. In this theater, there are some people who came to church this morning with their families, and they're going to leave with their families. And at the end of the service, they're going to go back and have a great time with maybe some other friends and family, and it will be a wonderful Sunday afternoon of fellowship and joy. But then there are some who came here all by themselves. And if nobody in here opens their eyes and sees that the worker God is calling them to be is someone who extends grace and hospitality to a stranger, maybe they'll go back into another lonely Sunday afternoon. The story teaches us that God is an employer, and all of us ought to see ourselves as people whom He is sending to work in this world. You see that? All right, so much for the part of the image that these men had that was correct. Because what happens next in Jesus' story is we see where they got it wrong. Let's look at what happens next. Look at verse 8. When evening came, that means the day of work was done. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay." This is the hinge on which this story turns, and this is where those questioners had it wrong. They had it right in knowing that God was an employer because God wants all of us to be at work. They had it wrong because they believed that the good thing that God had to give to them was something that they could earn. That was the first guy's mistake. And the second guy believed that all the work he did had earned him something good too. Now, isn't it the most natural thing in the world when you think of an employer and employees to think that the more you work, the more you get paid? That makes sense, doesn't it? Watch what happens in the story Jesus tells, because what happens there, it doesn't make sense. Look, before we look at the rest of these verses, I just need to remind you of this. In the opening scenes of the story, there were three interactions differently with the workers that involved pay. Did you see what happened with the first workers? It's there, I think it's in verse 1, let's see. In verse 2, after this landowner meets the first workers at 6 a.m., look what it says. He agreed with them, and they with him, to work for the ordinary daily wage. In this culture, that was called a denarius. It would be like whatever you got paid for doing a full day's of work. At 6 a.m., they sat there face-to-face with the landowner. He said, "What do you want to get for this? We need the daily wage." He said, "You got it." In other words, the first workers at 6 were told that they would get a normal day's pay for a normal day's work. Now, the second time he went out, and the third and fourth times, at 9, at noon, and 3, he told them that they would go out and that he would pay them what was right. You see the difference there? He never said to them, the ones who got hired at 9 and the ones who got hired at noon, that they would get paid a full day's wages. He said, "I'll pay you what's right." And they trusted him. Incidentally, look at the last guy and what the landowner said to him. He just said, "You go to work." Maybe he didn't expect to get anything because it was only going to be an hour after all. Now back to the story. In Jesus' story, at the end of this day, all of those workers are called back together, and the landowner tells the manager, "You bring them in and pay them what is right," and this is what happens. And this is where it gets a little funny. Beginning with the last and then going to the first. Now picture this. This landowner wants the guys who started at 5 o'clock to get paid first, and the ones who started at 6 a.m. to get paid last, and this is the reason. He wants everyone to see what the one who has only been working for 1 hour is going to get paid. Look at this. You see what it says there in verse 9? When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now picture yourself there. Well, first of all, you're one of the people who started at 5. You worked for an hour, and do you know what you got? You got just what you needed to support your family, as if you had been working all day. How do you feel? Yes, sweet. I heard some whispers. I feel great. Now, listen. You're the person who started at 6 a.m., and you're watching this happen. What do you think? This is what the people in Jesus' story thought. Look at this. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more. They looked at this and they said, "All right, if this guy worked for 1 hour and got a normal daily's wage, I work 12 times as much, I'm going to get 12 days worth of pay for the work I did." And in their minds, and in the minds of those of us who begin to believe that God pays us on the basis of what we do, as if we work and then God becomes our debtor, we do the same thing. And in one way, that makes sense to think, doesn't it? That if I do this much and this is my employer, well then he owes me that much because that employer owes me whatever I did. Let me show you how strikingly unlike that sort of employer God is. But each of them also received the usual daily wage. I asked my two sons what they thought of this. And they said, that's unfair. How could he possibly do this? Well, look how they responded. When those hired at about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. The others thought that they should receive the same. In verse 11, and when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. They looked at the situation, and they said, this is absolutely unfair, because they only worked for 1 hour, and we worked all day, and we worked all day when it was hot, and you've only given us the daily wage. That's totally unfair. Now listen, is it unfair? I see some people shaking their head, no. I see some people shaking their head, yes. Listen, it is unfair if the relationship between the landowner and the workers is that the landowner owes the workers something on the basis of what they did. If that's the truth, then it's unfair. But do you think that's the case here? Because, and look what Jesus, this is amazing. Look how the person responds to Jesus. He replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Did he? Yes. That was the deal. The deal was, you work for the day, and I pay you for the day. And that's what he did. Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Now, here is the crux of where the image that these men had in their mind was wrong. It's very simple. The moment any worker begins to act as if they have a claim upon this particular landowner, they've got it wrong. And here's the reason. That landowner did not need to leave his land and go out into the town square. He didn't. And that landowner could have picked other people to work, but he chose to pick these guys. And that's the prerogative of the landowner who we meet when we meet God, because God owes us nothing. Does that sound harsh to you? That God owes us nothing? It's the truth. And that's the truth in this story. Again, everyone who heard the story would have known the landowner never leaves his place to go get people. This is a gracious landowner from the beginning. He's giving these guys work because he's kind, not because they've earned it. He went out to them at 6 a.m. They didn't come to him. And God comes to each one of us and gives us a chance to work in this world, not because we have earned something, but because he's so good and gracious. And every one of us is in that same boat. And the danger that comes with that sort of world is that the moment a person receives something gracious, some gift from God that they didn't deserve, and many of you know here, by the way, that once you were lost and you've been found because God is good. And it's so easy to take a gift like that in the morning and then by noon to forget that it was a gift and begin believing that you earned it. And when you do that, you turn sour, you no longer accept the gift with joy, and you look around at everyone else who this landowner is gracious to, and you feel like it's unfair, and you want justice. Do you see what I mean? I want to tell you this story that my friend Jared told me when I was talking to him about this sermon, because I think it puts this in some of the brightest terms. Or imagine you're a room full of graduate students. Got it? Any of you been graduate students? You know the pressure to get good grades, right? This is a real story. A professor had a room full of about this many people, graduate students, and he said at the beginning of the year, students, there's going to be 3 papers, and if a paper is handed in late, you will get a 0 on it. Make sure that you have your papers in on time. The first paper was due, and the next day, the professor got up in front of the class, and he said to the students of about this many, he said, out of the 120 of you that are here, 18 of you had your papers in late. Now, I had a conversation with several of you, and because of the extenuating circumstances, I've decided to give you grace and let you hand them in late, those of you who need to. I'm extending a period of 1 week of amnesty. Now, make sure you get them in, because this is the last time I'll do this. The second paper is due. This time, guess how many are late? Almost 30. Again, the professor stands before the class. I regret to inform this class that now 30 of you have handed in your papers late. I talked with some of you. You gave me good excuses. I want to be gracious because I want you to succeed. I'm going to extend the period of grace one more time. But let me tell you this. I will not do so for the final. Those of you who handed in your paper late this time may get it in the next 2 days. But this is the last time I will do it. The final must be handed in on time. The final paper is due. Over 40 are late. The professor stands up before the class and he says, 40 of you handed in your final papers late. You all have failed. Now, the class is angry. there's some grumbling going on. There's some, especially the further away from the professor, the people up front are too afraid, but in the back, they start to grumble. Oh, I can't believe this. This is so unfair. How could he possibly do this? They start going crazy. There's one very courageous guy in the back, and he stands up with his papers in his hand. He says, "Professor, this is egregious!" He says that. That's from the office. He's so angry. He says, "How could this be? This is not right. This is unfair. You extended the grace before. We deserve this. This is wrong. We should get this period of grace once more. This is not right. I demand justice." And everybody in the class is looking at him, and they're thinking, "This is amazing. Oh my gosh, he's so perfect, this guy." And they all look at the professor to see what he'll do. And this is what the professor says. He says, "You want justice? As I recall, you handed both of your first two papers in late, so you have zeros on those as well. Does anyone else want justice?" There were no more hands that were raised. I think Jesus knows that one of the most corrosive things in every heart, in the heart of those two men who asked that question that morning, and in all of our hearts too, is that while on the one hand we can receive grace at one time and be glad for it, it is almost always the case that we begin to twist that grace into something we think we've earned and we have a right to. And the truth is, when you start acting like that with God, you have crossed a line from being a thankful recipient of the joyful kindness of God to someone who grudgingly believes that you've earned your place before him, and therefore you cut yourself off for him so that he can no longer be gracious to you. And this story ought to do this to us. It ought to shake all of us up and remind us to get back on this other side where we're ready to receive what God gives freely, not because we've earned it. If we will not do that, we will forever be people who are joyless and constantly comparing ourselves to others and grumbling because God is gracious to them. And then he will say to us, like this landowner said to those workers, "Take what's yours and leave. Go away from me. I don't want to be in your presence." Now, thankfully, unlike that professor, God's grace is infinite. And I want you to look at how Jesus ends his story. This is amazing. Look at verse 15. He says, "Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first and the first will be last." I want to ask you to think with me for a moment on that question in verse 15. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? This is a question that God asks every person who has begun to believe that they've earned their position before God. God looks at each one of us who's in that place and says, "Am I not allowed to do what I want with what's mine?" Do you know what belongs to God? Grace. God has the power and freedom to go after a woman who has been estranged from him, or a man who's altogether lost, and grab a hold of that person and bring them back. God has strength. The strength to reach his hand out to us while we're sinking in the mire and to pick us up and set our feet upon the rock. God has skill. God has the skill to take every broken life that's broken because we've turned away from him and done everything wrong. He has the skill to take that life and put it back together again. God has light, the light to shine into the darkest situation, the darkness that we are in because we've run away from him. He has light to shine into that darkness. He has grace, the grace to grab a hold of a dead person and bring them to life again. All of these things are God's. He has the knowledge to guide us in the way of truth. He has the wisdom that comes from his word. All of these things are his. Now, this is the second question. What does he choose to do with them? And do you know what this story teaches us? God chooses to give his power to lost people who don't deserve it. God chooses to use his strength to pick someone up who's there because of their own fault. That's what God chooses to do with his strength. God chooses to shine his light into lives that are dark because people have become his enemies by turning away from him, spitting in his face, going far from him, and saying, "I want nothing to do with you," and then hoveling down in the darkness and ruining their lives because they can't see anything. God chooses to shine the light into lives like that. He chooses to use his wisdom for people who are altogether lost because they've turned away from his word. He chooses to use his peace to fix an anxious heart that's anxious because it's lost itself in sin. This is what God chooses to do with what's His. And we are not people who can tell Him what He should or shouldn't do with what's His. And not only are we people who can't tell Him that, I want to finish by saying this. We are people who should not tell Him that. Because the moment any one of us tells God that He should only give people what they deserve, do you know who we've ruined? Ourselves. Thank God that He chooses to give what is His to people who don't deserve it. Because that means all of us are the recipients of the goodness and the grace and the love and the patience and the peace and the joy that we could never earn, but that has been poured out on us freely because of God's love for us. And that is the only word that explains why this landowner acts like he does. Love. This is a God that I want to live in your mind and in mine so that we live differently in this world. Let's pray.